from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Federal prosecutors are coming down hard on the giant hedge fund SAC Capital. SAC, as in founder, billionaire Stephen A. Cohen. The Securities and Exchange Commission is coming after him personally with civil charges for failure to prevent insider trading. Will the charges stick? And what about beyond? Is this Washington getting tough on Wall Street? This hour on Point, insider trading charges and federal oversight of Wall Street. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's the lesson in this hedge fund story? Do these indictments mean a tougher Washington hand? Join us anytime at On Point Radio or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thursday news conference, Manhattan U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, tough, describing alleged insider trading that he said took place at SAC Capital.
SAC trafficked in inside information on a scale without any known precedent in the history of hedge funds. As described in the indictment, the scope of illegal trading was deep and it was wide.
Deep and wide, and here comes the federal prosecutor out of Manhattan and the Security and Exchange Commission, SEC, already on Stephen Cohen. Out of Washington, joining me now from New York is Ben Protas, business reporter for the New York Times. Ben, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So here we go with these indictments, but there are two things going on. One, a lot of indictments we saw last week. Already before that, the SAC was moving on Stephen Cohen himself. Can you sort out the different strands here for us, Ben?
Sure. So the SEC is going to be has already charged Mr. Cohen civilly, lower burden of proof there. And that's about a failure to supervise his employees who have been accused of insider trading. So that's kind of on the one realm you have that civil case going. Those are just the regulators. Then you have the federal prosecutors coming after the fund itself and indicting the fund, this very unusual move to indict a large corporation, and that came Thursday. That, however, we're not just talking about fines, and we're not just talking about kind of putting the pressure on somebody. We're talking about potentially putting this company out of business.
Describe just how big this fund is.
So we're talking at this point, at the beginning of the year, is about $14 billion in assets under management. Now it's believed to be more in the range of about 10 or 11. A lot of the big investors have started to pull money from SAC as this insider trading investigation has ratcheted up. So right now we're looking at about 10 or 11 billion. About 8 of that is from Stephen A. Cohen's money, his own personal fortune. So potentially, even if investors continue to pull out, Mr. Cohen would still have his fortune there.
He's one of the most successful investors in history. Does it mean SAC would go on with his money at the heart of it and, maybe everybody else gone?
That's the big question everybody's asking. So I think on one hand, it's very hard to operate, retain employees, and make sure that the government kind of continues to allow you to operate. In this case, they do seem to be, not pressing them to shut down anytime soon. There's no immediate pressure there. However, you have to retain employees and keep your investors there. So one route is potentially to shut down SAC as we know it and make it what's known as a family office, which would allow Mr. Cohen to continue to manage his money. However, you're not going to retain all of those 1,000 employees to manage just Mr. Cohen's money. So again, there's a real threat to how this hedge fund exists.
Now, before the SEC civil charges against Stephen Cohen, and before this raft of indictments that we saw last week, there had already been legal action against employees of SAC. Like what, Ben?
So we've seen currently 5 employees who have already pleaded guilty to securities fraud, essentially insider trading. There's a 6th who has pleaded guilty to insider trading charges at another hedge fund, but also worked at SAC. And then there's a few other employees who've also been charged, but not yet either pleaded guilty or convicted. And 2 of those cases are going to be playing out in their trials starting in November. And so I think we've been seeing, off and on for a decade, we've seen the SEC and we've seen prosecutors in Manhattan really pursue SAC as a target, but really that has grown in the last 4 or 5 years when people came to see SAC as one of the main targets in this broad sweeping investigation.
Is this a slam dunk case if they already have had indictments for some years or not?
Yeah, well, so the challenge for SAC, there's not many defenses that they can mount here because essentially under the theory of corporate criminal liability, which is what the prosecutors are relying on here, you can attribute the bad acts of employees to the company itself, assuming it's not just a rogue employee. Here you have 6 people who are going to be willing to probably get up on the stand and say, we broke the law and SAC failed to prevent us from doing it. mounting that kind of prosecution, it's very hard to rebut that kind of case. The best thing that SAC can do is say, look, these are some, six employees, they're rogue, it doesn't reflect all the good actions of all of our many employees, we have 1,000 employees overall. That's a very, very difficult case to mount if you're the defense.
Ben, most people listening to this show don't work at hedge funds or even invest in or through hedge funds. Can you describe this line between what hedge funds are presumed to do, expected to do, and insider trading, the sort of contested terrain, perhaps, that we're seeing made very public in this case?
That's at the heart of what a lot of the defense cases have been in this insider trading crackdown, is that this is the government pursuing normal, typical research, right? So any kind of trader at a hedge fund, what they have to do is do analysis, do research, bone up on the industry that they're trading in. So if it's the tech industry, you have to know kind of how Dell is performing and what's going on with Dell.
Mm-hmm.
What the government says is that the people at SAC took it a step further and crossed that line and actually got inside information about Dell and actually got earnings information leaked ahead of the earnings report. And so there is a line. It's a little bit of a fuzzy gray area at times, but the government here would say when you're getting material, non-public information, that's where you cross the line, and then you have to trade on it.
And the significance of this is, I don't know, the small investor sitting in Montana with a little portfolio trying to do their own research on these companies can do that and play on Wall Street, and good luck to them. But if hedge fund employees have, I don't know, 3 martini lunches with guys who are telling them what the news that's going to come out tomorrow, that is just an unfair advantage.
And that's why, a lot of people have said, why is the government so aggressive in this crackdown? It's a victimless crime. The government would say, actually, it's not a victimless crime. You are disadvantaging everyday, mom-and-pop investors who don't have that thick, rich vein of inside information that they can tap into. And so which your point is absolutely well taken, is that, when you kind of have that close window into kind of Wall Street and you connect to the various companies that you're covering, you have an upside and you have an upper hand that the average investor just doesn't.
Ben, respond to this comment from one of our listeners online. Thomas says, I think anybody working on Wall Street is guilty of insider trading, or at least profiting from it. I think every politician in Washington also guilty. Give any of these clowns, Wall Street or Washington, a basic IRA and no contact list, and watch the returns return to average. Anybody getting above average returns on investment year after year? Cheating, pure and simple. What do you say to that listener view?
I think that view is actually quite reflective of how a lot of people are viewing Wall Street nowadays, and Washington for that matter. I do think that there are honest people on Wall Street, and there may even be a few honest people in Washington. I think that the challenge is that when you see, in this case, you have 80 charges in insider trading in the last few years, 73 convictions, it's hard to not have a cynical view about how the industry has pursued its upper hand. The thing to keep in mind, obviously, is that that's 80 people out of a much broader industry of people.
Is it fair to say with that Washington is getting tough on Wall Street? I mean, these federal prosecutors in Manhattan, SEC,
right,
is, of course, under Mary Jo White, the new chairwoman down in Washington. Do you see Washington tougher on Wall Street? Fair headline here, or just doing its business?
It's a great question. I think it's too soon to tell. I think for now what we are seeing is that this case against SAC has been about a decade in the making, off and on, especially in the last few years. It's been really heating up. And so I would not necessarily read too much into this one indictment and this one charge against Mr. Cohen, again, a civil charge. I think that perhaps there is an inkling of some change from the SEC. Mary Jo White, as you mentioned, is now the chairman of the SEC. She's a former federal prosecutor. She's also a former defense lawyer, of course, for Wall Street firms.
Yeah.
So, but she has been signaling a somewhat tougher approach to enforcement cases and to pursuing Wall Street wrongdoing. But I think what we have to see is, how does this play out over the next 2-3 years? The first few months are really only kind of a little bit of a test. We have to kind of see this play out.
I mean, your headline a week ago was, under new chief, a feistier SEC. And you cited their moves against Stephen Cohen, the civil side of what became a criminal against the firm last week. Their moves against hedge fund manager Philip Falcone. The move even against the city of Miami on securities fraud.
The thing that's so fascinating about the Falcone case is that it had reflected a settlement that had been reached between Mr. Falcone, another hedge fund manager, and the SEC's enforcement unit. Mary Jo White and the other commissioners at the SEC actually overruled that settlement, which is incredibly rare. You know, people you talk to usually said it happens maybe once or twice.
Why'd they do it? What for? What did they get
further? They
thought
it was too lax. They thought that the settlement, basically Mr. Falcone was only going to be charged with a limited number of things. In the ultimate resolution of the settlement, was only going to have to pay about $4 million himself out of his own pocket. And people really felt at the SEC that that was just too light of a punishment. And it's very rare. Normally, the commissioners will defer to the enforcement, defer to the investigators. In this case, they actually put their foot down and said, no, we have to be tougher. So I do think that you're right in citing our headline there. It is a feistier SEC, and Mary Jo White certainly has signaled that. But the question is this a feistier few months, or is this going to be something that, you know, really actually effectuates change over the course of her tenure?
We're going to look at that. Interesting wrinkle also, instead of just big settlements without firms actually conceding wrongdoing, if I read you right, the SEC is now saying, no, we want you to concede that you were guilty.
That is one possible option. They're not going to do it in every case, but they are already kind of pursuing that in certain cases, which is a major sea change for them.
Not just plunk down a few million or 100 million and on your merry way, but something tougher. Ben Protas is a business reporter with the New York Times, joins us today from New York City. Ben, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking this hour if Washington maybe at last is getting tougher on Wall Street. Indictments last week of a big hedge fund on insider trading. Talk of a tougher SEC. On Wednesday in Manhattan, U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara said insider trading at SEC goes beyond individual instances of illegal acts.
When so many people from a single hedge fund have engaged in insider trading, it is not a coincidence. It is instead the predictable product of substantial and pervasive institutional failure.
How much will it hurt the firm, this giant hedge fund? Former SEC Chairman Harvey Pitt told CNBC on Wednesday that, indictment or not, damage will be inescapable for SEC Capital.
The damage has already been done to the firm, and I think money will start flowing in droves out of the firm.
Of course, Stephen Cohen has billions of his own money in there, which may be going nowhere. Here's SEC Chair, relatively new, Mary Jo White, talking with the Wall Street Journal last month. She said there are times when agreeing to a no-admit, no-deny deal with a company, just a big fine, but, you know, nothing conceded, may still be a good way to recoup money and put down some punishment, but that if the fraud is egregious enough, she said, and the harm to investors great enough, the SEC may well go for full admission of guilt.
We are going to, in certain cases, I think, be seeking admissions going forward. I think accountability, public accountability, in particular kinds of cases can be quite important. And if you don't get them, you litigate them.
Let's dive on in here. With us now from New York is Gregory Zuckerman, Wall Street Journal reporter covering money, investing. Gregory Zuckerman, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Great to be here.
Author of The Greatest Trade Ever. And from New York, Jonathan Weil joins us, columnist for Bloomberg News. He says the indictment is just a mission accomplished banner for the SEC, for federal prosecutors. Jonathan Weil, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
If I got you right, you're saying we've got a mission accomplished banner here, as in what? On the deck of the aircraft carrier, well before any kind of real victory in Iraq? What are you saying with that?
Well, I didn't say that in the column. I've been thinking that it's an exaggeration, just to make to make a point. The feds have been using this case and all the insider trading cases to say, look, Wall Street, we're on. You know, we got them, and we're cracking down on Wall Street. And the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008 is still very fresh in people's minds. And so when they say that we're cracking down on Wall Street, it's actually hedge funds. Wall Street that got us in trouble in 2008 consists of major investment banks and the like. And we haven't seen anybody from the head of a major financial services company be indicted for anything that happened, as if all of their financial statements were completely credible and contained no errors or fraud or misleading information. that was prosecutable, which I just I'm still flabbergasted that we haven't had any prosecutions post 2008 senior Wall Street officials. But mm-hmm. To them, they're just saying, well, we're going after Wall Street. That means insider trading and hedge funds.
We'll back up and look at those bigger, maybe systemic issues. Greg Zuckerman, what about this case? Is it sort of universally agreed on Wall Street? Is everybody nodding along saying, yep, that looks like insider trading? Or is this just the way the investment game is played at the hedge fund level and they feel like, SEC capital is getting a bad deal?
Well, the case has had a real chilling effect on the behavior of hedge fund managers and investors and traders. And I'm not saying it's going to last forever. These things tend to last a few years or so, and that's about it. But they are changing the way they operate. So to that extent, the prosecutors already are having some effect. There's some deterrence factor. But in terms of your question of the reaction, no. I talked to some traders, and they think that the accusations aren't necessarily a layup for the government. One of them that they highlighted, the government highlighted, an employee of SEC said that he – the accusation is that he knew the quarter cold. In other words, he knew what the company was going to report on its earnings. And part of the reason is because he had a timeshare in the Hamptons with not an executive of that said company, but somebody else in the industry. And I'm not saying that there wasn't insider trading here, but it's a little more gray than the prosecutors potentially make it out to be.
And what about Jonathan Wild's So hold on here to talk about this as evidence of Washington getting tough on Wall Street. He's saying this is kind of at the edges of what was a bigger systemic, maybe structural problem back in 07, 08, and maybe right now as well, Gregory.
Oh, I completely agree that the government has either struck out or decided not to take a swing at those who actually were responsible for the financial meltdown. And frankly, I'm not sure they had great cases there as well, but they clearly got criticism for that. And in some ways, they kind of shifted. And hedge funds do a lot of right, do a lot of wrong, but they really weren't at the heart of the financial crisis. That's not to say that you can't go after bad actors in the hedge fund world, presuming they're doing so.
But they are in the gun sites, the target sites right now of federal prosecutors. Jay in New Haven, Connecticut's calling. Hi, Jay. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. Thank you, Tom. And thanks for your show.
Mm-hmm.
My question is this. For there to be insider trading, there obviously has to be an insider and some inside information. And I wonder if the guests could help the rest of us understand the blurry line between honest research and insider trading. I would guess it's related to how high up the corporate chain the source of the information is, like Gupta and the Galleon Fund.
Yep.
But I wonder if it's also related to the nature of the information, if it's about to be in a press release in an hour versus just finding out what does your order book look like for the Midwest for the next quarter.
Yeah, exactly. Jay, thanks for your call. Jonathan Weil, what about that line? And, how it's defined, where is it? And I mean, what, SAC Capital had 30% returns very often. Can you get that just looking at order books?
They might say yes. There's the question of were they the Lance Armstrong of hedge fund trading? To answer the caller's question, it is fuzzy in the statutes, and there's been a whole body of case law that's developed around what is inside information, what is securities fraud and trading illegally. Usually, it involves a breach of fiduciary relationship by someone at the company or someone stealing information from a company. And it has to be material, and then that's the easy part. Now, defining
and
all that.
Explain what that might mean in material terms, like information like what that should be protected.
It's fuzzy, but sometimes it's fuzzy. It's something that would be considered significant to an investor.
We're going to miss our earnings target tomorrow.
That's a black and white instance.
Right. Okay.
What's not so black and white is there's an instance in here where a cousin of a friend of mine, or it was a friend of my cousin at this company, says that, the second quarter is going to be horrible. Be careful.
Okay.
Now, do I know who the cousin is? Do I know who the friend is? Do I know what horrible is in that person's mind as opposed to somebody else's? As an outsider looking in, reading the indictment, that summation of the allegation, I have no idea. if that's a prosecutable case, and that's what we have trials for.
But you've said that SAC, you know, it makes you look cross-eyed in a hurry because they've got some really fast trading here, holding stocks very often for just a month or so. That's not like looking—
Or a second.
Okay. How does that indicate that it might be trading on, you know, short-term inside information?
Well, you need— communications should show who is talking to whom, whether it's in the form of instant messages or wiretapping, which we got the first indication that the government may have actually had some wiretaps in this case. But it is all very case-by-case basis. Nobody can give anybody a simple one, two-sentence definition that will apply to everything. And if you ask for somebody for one, and you keep looking for it, you're just going to get frustrated.
What about these emails from Dell? Weren't there some of those in here? What are those?
Well, okay, so here's a great example. There was one of the people at SAC who said, I had a secondhand read from someone at the company that, and this was a message that was sent to Stephen Cohen allegedly, and indicating that gross margins would fall short by 50 to 80 basis points. And a basis point is 1/100th of a percentage point, but we don't need to go there.
Yep.
The point being that the information in that was actually turned out to be wrong because they fell short much worse than that.
Okay.
You can't tell if Stephen Cohen was not indicted here. He received the message allegedly. His lawyers say he didn't read it.
1,000 emails a day. Who has time to read all that?
Yeah, well, literally, that's what they said.
Information. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
And then beyond that, secondhand read from someone at the company. Well, even if it's someone at the company, did that person at the company violate some fiduciary obligation to the company in whatever he said? It is not illegal to talk to employees of public companies, believe it or not.
And there's a lot of talking going on. Yeah, hang on a second. Gregory Zuckerman, I want to come to you. Let me get another call here. Harvard, Massachusetts. Fritz is calling. Fritz, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you see?
So I've basically spent most of my career in this industry, and I would certainly say that the SEC is not doing too little. And I spent some time in the hedge fund world, and in that world, it's getting harder and harder as there are more and more hedge funds to gain competitive advantage. And so they're always talking about, well, what's your edge? And if you're going to come to work for me at SAC Capital, you've got to bring an edge. And oftentimes, well, the only edge available is to go find information that other people don't have. And to me, it's those people who are doing that, it's pretty clear to them, if you have any common sense, that if I'm getting this kind of information, this isn't fair, but I want to keep my job at SAC Capital. I want to make money, so I'm going to just continue to do it. So I think that this is, I hope that they continue to do these investigations and, you know, basically level the playing field.
If they don't, is the investment game rigged, Fritz?
Yeah, it is. It's rigged. And if you're not in on it, you're not going to make 30% returns the way these firms have. They're not that much smarter than everybody else.
Fritz, I appreciate your call. Gregory Zuckerman, there's a call from a guy who's worked inside. What do you say to his insider perspective?
Well, his argument is that if you want to beat the market within the hour, within the day, then it is difficult and challenging. And there's a frustration out there that SAC had these remarkable returns. It's not just the remarkable returns. They were charging an arm and a leg of their investors. So the returns were after these fees of 3.5% management fees and 50% of all their profits.
And they were still great returns. Unbelievable.
And they still were great returns, which is why, frankly, there were always accusations, whispers. People would always ask me, when are they going after SAC? And frankly, there wasn't much evidence to back up the suspicions other than these remarkable returns. So for those who are trying to beat the market sort of over the next day or so, I get the frustration and they don't have an edge. Frankly, there's a real strong argument that it's actually better for smaller investors, this kind of craze, this focus on the short term.
Why would
that
be?
Guys,
if the hedge fund's making out like a bandit and you know, regular returns for a lot of people have been pretty lousy, not 30%, that's for sure.
Well, I've actually been quite good since 2009. If you're a longer-term investor, the market still goes where the economy goes. If you can not get as caught up in the day-to-day as these hedge fund managers, with everybody so short-term focused, there is less competition for those who are longer-term focused is the argument, and I subscribe to that argument.
But what about fairness here? I mean, Jonathan, you point out if you're buying stock and you're holding it for 30 days, maybe less, you know, can you really do that and be right about a short-term sort of random movement in that stock unless someone's tipped you off? And if you're doing that, is that corrupting the system? Gregory says maybe it's good long-term to keep things popping.
I'm not here to be the put aside SAC Capital for the moment and what and the
pretty big shit to put aside, but okay.
Put aside. If you are allowed to do research, and sure, someone who does research the stocks that he or she buys should have an edge on someone who just throws a dart at a dartboard. That's just common sense to me. If you have in research, might not be anything more than watching Apple's first, you know, iPod commercials years ago with the dangling headsets and realizing, you know, something clicks. Say, that's going to be really cool. That's going to take
but
off.
That's different. My kids anybody are sitting can here, do that.
Yeah. Anybody. Well, but you could have made a lot of money on Apple doing that. Now that as far as. But as far as deep research, I mean, is it illegal to go to a conference for a particular industry and watch what the panelists have to say and draw information on that? I mean, this is where we got to start talking and then going up to people afterward and asking, you know, Q&A. You know, at some point, that's where research starts. At another point, you can obviously cross lines. There's an example in this indictment where allegedly one of the analysts had advanced information about a Yahoo earnings release, I think it was, and a partnership between Yahoo and Microsoft. If true, that clearly is over the line. That's not research. That's just getting leaks. But, you know, when you're talking, there is a gray zone where in the process of doing really deep research and getting to know your industry, getting to know companies, you know, like a newspaper reporter would do, except trying to, you know, make money off of it, where you can cross the line. And that's what – and when – you know, my guess is that a lot of the reason that some of the stuff is going to trial or that some of the defendants are individually, you know, contesting the government's allegations is because they're not necessarily slam dunk cases.
Hey, Gregory, our investment business caller says, you know, this is where the game gets rigged. You say this might be all right, but most of our listeners, I don't have the kind of capital to be a client of Stephen Cohen and SAC Capital. I can't get in there and get that kind of return, even if I'm paying lots of attention to financial trends and reading all the, you know, the reports from different publicly traded companies. There's a lot of talk about the whole economy being rigged toward inequality. Does this just push it further that way and illegally so if you're over the line into real insider trading?
Yeah, no, listen, I don't want to in no way am I defending insider trading or people who are aggressive in trading by the hour and trying to beat the next quarter and doing so in a improper way.
And me neither.
No, okay. My only point being is that I don't think the average investor or listener should think it's a rigged market. There are bad actors for sure. But let's keep in mind that the market has done quite well because the economy has rebounded since early 2009 and the Fed's been loose with its money. So that hasn't affected people's returns. People's 401ks are looking better despite the bad actors and in insider trading, which is going on. And frankly, I do think that every so often the government needs to crack down, send a message, and it will last, I don't know, a few years or so, then I'll come back. I mean, look at what happened with Rudy Giuliani back in the day. For a number of years, there wasn't much in the way of insider trading on Wall Street. It was happening elsewhere, but there wasn't as much on Wall Street. And then it came back. So the government needs to do this every so often, unfortunately.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're asking this hour if Washington maybe at last is getting tougher on Wall Street. Indictments last week of a big hedge fund on insider trading. Talk of a tougher SEC. Jonathan Weil is with us, Bloomberg News columnist from New York. Gregory Zuckerman joins us, Wall Street Journal reporter, covers money and investing, author of The Greatest Trade Ever, the behind-the-scenes story of how John Paulson defied Wall Street and made financial history. Interesting comments online here, Gregory. Jonathan, Dave writes, he says, I wonder how many years in prison someone would get for robbing a bank of several billion dollars. For that matter, robbing a convenience store of a couple hundred compared to what we're looking at here. But Peter says, look, SAC, that's Stephen Cohen's hedge fund, has little or nothing to do with the major crimes that caused the economic crash. When Jamie Dimon and the others are on trial, I'll applaud the tough new stance, Peter writes. Tried, convicted, and stripped of their wealth is too good for those who crashed our economy and the world's economy. Jonathan Wild, your point being this sort of tough stuff on Wall Street really doesn't go to those bigger systemic structural questions.
If there are crimes that are committed and the prosecutors can prove them and they have the evidence, they should go after them. But don't build this as, see, the government and the administration have cracked down on Wall Street. Move on. That's the way that this has been billed publicly for the past few years, this whole drumbeat of cases. These are cases that are worth bringing. I don't dispute that. I don't think the SAC capital indictment itself is a slam dunk by any measure, even though they have five at least cooperating witnesses who've pleaded guilty to conduct while employed by SEC. Because those people, once they get on the witness stand, you never know how credible they're going to come across and whether they'll come across as having copped pleas out of fear of worse things that could happen to them. But I'm astounded that the Justice Department has been advertising, see, we're getting tough on financial crimes and they can't find any cases at systemically important financial institutions.
Greg Zuckerman, you said within this investing world, I guess the Stephen Cohen story makes him a little bit like the Yankees' A-Rod. You know, maybe he wasn't cheating. Maybe he cheated a little. Maybe he cheated the whole time. Describe the A-Rod parallel.
Yeah, I mean, he's the kind of guy who hit home runs after home runs for years. And just taking a step back, I'll just kind of shed some light on the operation over there. So basically, he sat on the trading floor, huge trading floor in Connecticut.
1,000 people and, around him or something like that.
All over the firm, but there were hundreds on that trading floor. And it was sort of a pyramid. So the best ideas would flow up. There were different – he had a fascinating setup, so such that different groups – and he would be on the trading floor, but it wasn't flat whatsoever. He was at the top of the pyramid, and the best ideas would keep flowing up, and the best of the best of the best would go to him. And you know, there's some plausible deniability potentially, where sometimes it would just be an amazing idea. He wouldn't necessarily have to know so much about where it came from. It's not to say that he didn't ask questions. I don't want to get into the legality of it. But it was a fascinating setup there. And he was a trader. And frankly, people on Wall Street understand how other people make gains. If you're like a value kind of investor, or you're an activist, you take a position, a public position, you work on a company, it goes up, you get it. People didn't get how Steve Cohen did so well. For a while in the sort of the 90s when their IPO market was hot, remember back in those days, everyone always kind of whispered, well, he was getting IPO shares, initial public offering shares ahead of everyone else. He was getting favors by Wall Street firms because he was so big and because he had generated so much commission with Wall Street. But then IPOs kind of slowed down and he still was doing quite well and it led to more suspicions.
So here's this big brain, very, very successful, multi-billionaire himself, sitting in the middle of all these people gathering information for him, working tiny edges and turning them into big returns. Is it credible to you when he says, look, I got 1,000 emails a day. I don't know if I had insider trading information in there. Is that credible? I mean, he didn't make all those big gains by not knowing where stuff was coming from and what its significance was.
I frankly can't judge that. I do know that 1,000 emails is a lot of emails. I'm not sure how many he went through. I do know he's a brilliant trader, and I do know that he does things differently than most on Wall Street. And I do know that he's had a number of people working for him who've been indicted and convicted, and it doesn't look too good. I mean, he would argue that, well, geez, I have all these thousands of people, so hey, you know, 6-8 of them get indicted or get convicted. You know, that's a small percentage, but it looks pretty bad.
Let me get a couple callers right here. Dubuque, Iowa. Aaron is calling. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I think we phrased this conversation about Wall Street and the issues in Wall Street, but for me, I think it's kind of telling about where we're at from a government and society standpoint that, you know, your caller keeps talking about if you have a case, take it to court and prosecute. But it's really an issue of resources, isn't it? I mean, if we decided that insider trading and that the ability to completely artificially and intentionally manipulate a market and affect 650 million people locally, not to mention globally, was a priority, we dedicate the resources to make those cases. But we don't. We dedicate those resources to public surveillance and a failed drug war. And you look at the amount of financial and manpower resources there versus regulating this enormous industry that has really the freedom to do almost whatever they want to. And while there are an enormous number of traders, I'm sure the vast majority are very ethical and operate in a legal manner, you can't argue that there is definitely a draw for folks to operate on greed and have questionable ethics and questionable morals.
But Aaron, let me ask you, I mean, we know that good financial markets are important for a well-functioning economy. You need that. Here's the SEC. They've been watching. They've gone in there and had some big fines, even when they didn't get all the way to prosecution. People paying big fines, even if they didn't concede guilt, there were fines in there. How about that?
But isn't the admission of guilt really what's important? I mean, this is a personal principle, but
yeah.
I think that admission of guilt to say, yeah, we made a mistake, and now we're never allowed to do it again. The people who went out on this limb and really affected everyone on the planet directly.
Well, you're talking at things that led to the financial crash.
We're talking about two different things, the crash specifically. But, I mean, it's bigger and smaller than that, right? It's not isolated to this one incident.
No, I got it. And you want that admission of guilt. You want to nail it down and have responsibility be very clear. I appreciate your call, Aaron. Let me get one more, and we'll look at it. Jim in Harvard, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. A quick comment. I thought your guest was reckless in suggesting that because everyone's 401ks and funds are doing well, that no harm is happening. Clearly, when there were trillions of dollars of trades, a fraction of that can make some individuals very, very wealthy and illegally. And the second thing is, in terms of your broader question, are things getting better? Well, we're starting from zero. You know, as far as I can see, what happened at Lehman was fraud. And yet no one prosecuted. So I, if you're starting from zero, anything would be an improvement, but that doesn't say much.
Market's up now, so it's all good. Maybe that's not a strong enough argument. I mean, Jonathan Wild, you hear, first of all, our caller in Iowa saying he wants to see, guilt stamped right on there, not just a fine. And then our caller in Massachusetts saying, come on, even if markets go up, if there was wrong, there's wrong, and I guess equity requires prosecution.
You know, you were asking before about the Securities and Exchange Commission, whether it's getting tougher. I mean, they had a settlement with SAC Capital back in April, I think it was, and they paid a huge fine. And one of the claims against SAC Capital had to do with the actions of a former analyst named John Horvath, who himself pleaded guilty to crimes over insider trading. He already done so. And then the Securities and Exchange Commission lets SAC settle that case just a few months ago without admitting or denying the allegations. This is pretty recent. Get this again. Neither admit nor deny settlement, even though the allegations against the fund were based in part upon somebody who had gone into court and pleaded guilty and said, I committed these crimes. Now, I have yet to see the commission bring a case like this where they actually did force, of this magnitude at least, where they actually did force an admission. Mary Jo White, the new commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Commission, has said that they will start going after admissions in cases. But to me, this was one of the most ridiculous instances of allowing a defendant, or Stephen Cohen's firm in particular, to settle civilly with no admissions whatsoever. I wrote about it at the time, and I'm still astounded that it happened this recently.
And what do you think of that practice, Gregory? We've heard about it for a long time. It comes out in the press, so-and-so, pays a fine of whatever, $300 million, but admits no guilt. Why does that happen, and should it?
Yeah, listen, I think it's been a point of frustration for many, for myself, for the average American, because people do want to see some admission of guilt. The argument of prosecutors is and regulators is, well, It's not a clear cut, some of these cases. We want to move on to the next one. Our resources are limited. And, you know, in this day and age, you know, to go back to your earlier caller's point, they do have limited resources, unfortunately, the SEC and Washington in general. So they would argue that it's a more efficient way to regulate by cutting these deals and then moving on and slapping them on the wrist and not getting them to admit guilt. But, I share those sentiments that you do want to see some admission, if only because it does sort of suggest maybe they're less likely to do it again, as opposed to, hey, we didn't do anything wrong here, we're moving on, we're paying a fine.
John in Watertown, Wisconsin. John, thanks for calling. You're on.
Yes, not a one person there is talking about the evil tenets of maniacal mad dog capitalism. That's what is triggering all this greed, pure greed and avarice. We have tens of thousands of crooks out here, and we're not doing a thing about prosecuting them, and we don't go and look over the system and see all the dirt that it has dredged up in the last 40, 50 years. It's 250 years old, and it was a system that started out pretty good, developed capital when there was none available, but now it's counterproductive. It's working against the American people. There are 100 million people out of work right now as we speak, and media is not standing up to it and telling the people the truth at all.
So, John, you're saying policing it well is not enough? What, you want to carve it up, toss it out?
We have to do like the emeritus professor from Yale said, look into the big C, look into capitalism, see what's wrong with it now, restructure it, get rid of it, kick it out. It's already 70% socialism anyway. We must enlighten the American people and tell them about all the crooks and what has all gone wrong. And the media is not doing that because they're all beholden to this obsolete, maniacal, toxic waste dump.
John, you make a very clear case, and I appreciate your calling. Jonathan Weil, you get enough inequity for long enough and enough people out of work, and exactly that attitude comes to the fore. I don't know if the SEC moves begin to approach that kind of concern.
I'll just let the caller's comments speak for themselves. That's something I can say that to.
Greg, I mean, look, that's somebody out there, Gregory, who's looking around. He's not wrong about all the unemployment. He's not wrong about the people who are really suffering these days. And you can see why people look and say, come on, we've got to put the plow in deeper here. We've got to turn over a little more than just a couple of indictments.
Yeah, listen, there's a lot of discontent out there. Listen, I'm a big fan of capitalism. My relatives came over from places that weren't capitalist, and this country has treated us much better. But unbridled capitalism I'm not a fan of, and I understand that sentiment. I think that's why we need sort of these crackdowns every so often to send a message. And there is a deterrent issue here. And that's part of it. To me, that's maybe the key reason they're doing this. And there's something to be said for that.
Is Jonathan, are the problems that we're talking about today related to deeper economic problems in this country? Is it dancing around, you know, on investment billions and no biggie? Or do you see them as related to underlying issues that may lead us to fewer jobs, less prosperity?
Well, I think one of the reasons that this case touches a chord is because we do have a widening gap of income inequality. And so you find, when one of the richest people in the country, one of the richest people in the world, is accused of running a hedge fund that's alleged to be a criminal enterprise, and he himself doesn't get indicted, I think that just fuels the types of animosity and class resentments that, you know, are growing as the economy gets to, you know, a more, you know, this is old story, but I mean that, you know, the middle class is diminishing, the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. And, you know, one of the things I think is frustrating to a lot of people too when they look at this case is, oh, sure, they're going after all of his billions one way or another, but they indict his firm and they don't indict him. What's up with that? That just doesn't make sense to a lot of people. It doesn't really make sense to me.
There are civil charges coming out there against Stephen Cohen. What kind of impact could those have on him?
They can knock him out of the business of managing other people's money.
But he can still manage his own billions, which is a pretty big business in itself.
Yes, in this country, if you have billions of dollars, you are allowed to manage those yourself. that's the upshot of that. But you know, the civil case isn't a slam dunk either. You just never. One of the things I covered the Arthur Anderson trial in Houston, and it was very similar in this respect. You have you had one or more people pleading guilty to crimes that the company itself was indicted for, and on paper, the conviction should be automatic as long as the jury believes the person testifying on the stand when he says, "I'm guilty, I did it." But what was interesting about the Anderson trial was that the person that they had for obstruction of justice who had pleaded guilty got on the stand for a week and was a complete dud. And the jurors, after the trial was over, said, "We disregarded what he said." They ended up convicting him on convicting the firm on something else.
Yep.
And then the case got overturned.
Hey, Gregory Zuckerman, trading is going on right now as we speak. What do you think? People hitting the brakes or business as usual, because that's the way it rolls?
On Wall Street, there's been a real impact, and people are being much more careful about trying not to go over that line. And I hope it lasts. I hope they continue to be as careful as potentially they are today.
We'll all be watching. Wall Street Journal reporter Gregory Zuckerman, thank you so much for being with us today, Greg.
Sure. Great to be here.
And Jonathan Wild, Bloomberg News columnist. Jonathan, terrific to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Tune in tomorrow. The president says in his big speech last week, invest or fail the middle class. We'll ask, what do Republicans say to that? 800-42—we've already done that. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.